Illinois' massive teacher shortage has left local superintendents like Chuck Blyer with few options when it comes to hiring.
The pool has dwindled drastically in the last 10 years. The pipeline of potential applicants have just dried up.
We look at what's behind the Illinois teacher shortage and what's being done to address it. And we'll hear about how two Belgian immigrants from Illinois became the youngest people to travel across the U.S. by bike.
They did about 70 miles a day, and they took the old Lincoln Highway. There were parts of the route that were absolutely just barren, arid wasteland.
Plus, what's red about palm size and native to Illinois? No, I'm not describing our state bird, the cardinal. It's the solo cup, of course. We hear about how one little plastic cup has a rich history in Urbana and beyond. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. That's all coming up on the 21st after the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. Like many other states, Illinois is facing a massive teacher shortage. But how massive are we talking? There were more than 2,000 teaching, administrative, supportive staff, and other positions that went unfilled across the state during the 2016-2017 school year. And that's according to a report from the Illinois State Board of Education. Substitute teacher positions, as well as rural areas and high-density urban areas, have been hit especially hard by these shortages. As a result, lawmakers in Springfield recently passed several measures to address the shortage. But are those measures enough? With me in our studio and here in Urbana is Lee Gaines. Lee is an education reporter for Illinois Newsroom, and she's been reporting on these issues. Lee, welcome back to the 21st, and thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Also joining me on the line is Chuck Blyer. Chuck is the superintendent for Wabash Community Unit School District 348 in Mount Carmel, Illinois, which is on the southeast corner of our state. Superintendent Blyer, I just want to welcome you, and thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Liz. Thank you for having me.
So, Lee, when we're talking about a teacher shortage, how big are we talking? We've heard a little bit about it in the introduction. I threw out some statistics there, but I'm to understand that certain areas are being hit harder than others.
Yeah, that's true. It's not a uniform shortage across the state. I would say that rural districts are definitely suffering more than suburban districts. And I would also note that some areas in places like Chicago are suffering too. So any schools where you have a lot of low-income children, low-resourced schools are also suffering quite a bit. And then there are a couple positions where the shortages are especially acute. So special education teachers are especially difficult to find. Bilingual teachers are also difficult to find, and also school psychologists.
And Superintendent Blyer, as someone who is making these hiring decisions, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how this shortage has affected your hiring pool and the process that you go through.
The pool has dwindled drastically in the last 10 years. The pipeline of potential applicants have just dried up. Exactly what was said with special ed, bilingual, of course. Vocational is another one that's been hit massively. Math, science, even when we would have an elementary education position open, it wouldn't be uncommon to see 30 applicants. Right now we're getting down to around 5. So that's how thin the application pool is out there right now.
Wow. And in your reporting, Lee, you had a chance to speak with Stacy Teft, who is a history teacher at Murfreesboro High School. That's also in Southern Illinois. So I'd like to take a listen to what she had to say about the shortages and how they're affecting the classroom.
It's always about the kids, and they deserve the best, and they deserve the best future they can have. And right now, I'm not sure they're getting that. Just because you do not have the best people going into the education field because it's not enticing at the moment.
So, Superintendent Blyer, I wonder, as you listen to this, what's your reaction? Are you hearing similar sentiments from teachers and other administrators about how these shortages are directly affecting the kids and the classrooms?
I am. She's right. She's, of course, in the trenches as a teacher, and I taught a long time. The field, the profession itself in Illinois, in one of my main opinions is that they've raised tuition prices at the universities to a point where a starting salary teacher would have a very difficult time paying off their loans. So they would start out with a lot of debt and a low-income job. And teaching is a profession that becomes better, I guess, financially the more you're in it due to a pay scale, usually in most school districts that have associations in them. So it's very difficult in the beginning. It takes a lot of effort, a lot of work in the beginning. But if you can't balance it out with paying off your tuition and your debt from college, it's a daunting task. And a lot of young people just don't want to start their lives with that kind of debt and pressure to succeed that fast. But it is a profession right now that if you got into it, being that there are so many openings, you could be employed basically immediately. However, the pool of the candidates, yes, she's right. You don't know what you're going to get these days because there just isn't that much competition for applicants right now.
So I know you're talking a lot about student debt, and finances are obviously a very important reason or factor when someone is looking to start their career off. I don't want to minimize that, but are you seeing that there are other reasons behind this shortage, or if there are other hurdles to attracting new teachers outside of just that student debt financial issue?
I consider that to be number one. Two, there's been a couple of, in the last 10 years, the state of Illinois has had issues with its budget, and they've been lax on getting money to the schools. So that the mindset of a young person thinking, okay, do I want to go into a field that has the subjugation of the state, you know, floating it or helping it stay afloat? And if they're not able to fulfill those bargains, or their end of the bargain, which is a state law, a state mandate, that they're not following, then you have young people just when they're on set of their career, like that doesn't look like a good, solid career choice. On top of that, I think I've talked about this before, but the constant media barrage of violence at schools and school shootings and bullying and the negative impact. And whenever there's a teacher that gets caught doing something wrong, it's front page news. It just is the culmination of the social impact and the financial impact on, at least at this state, has been rough on it.
Well, and Superintendent Blair, I'd like to talk a little bit about the social impact. Do you also find in talking to the teachers that you have employed or those that you are looking to hire that they feel that there is a lack of respect for what they do as a career, you know, that teachers aren't held in high enough regard?
Yes. And that you would talk to also with veteran teachers about. There many, the profession itself has been positioned into a way that it is always in the defensive. And when I was at least a lot younger, it was a more respected profession. That's not to say that it can't get there, it can't be that way. Mm-hmm. And you see pockets of it in each classroom. You have one teacher that will be achieving great success and is greatly respected. I'm not knocking the entire field whatsoever. But social impact tends to show education in somewhat of an aloof light. And I don't think that's fair whatsoever. Everybody's working really hard. And I've made this point before that the educational system, public ed system in this country, turns out millions of fine young adults every single year. But we get pigeonholed and nailed for what didn't go right. We never get the actual accolades for all of the successes that we get. And I think that wears on the profession.
Absolutely. And Lee, I'd like to switch gears a little bit. I believe Superintendent Blair in there mentioned it briefly, but can you get us caught up on some of the legislation that has been introduced to help address these teacher shortages?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of legislation, I should say, that's been introduced. One of the big packages was actually recently signed by Governor Rauner into law, and that was co-sponsored by Senator Menard and also Representative Tom Bennett. And that deals with teacher license reciprocity so that teachers who may have been licensed out of state can come to Illinois and get licensed here or be able to teach in schools here. That also involves some short-term substitute teacher licensing measures, and it also allows teachers in high need areas, so we're areas that are especially in need of teachers, retired teachers to come back and teach there for a slightly longer period of time than they were allowed to before without jeopardizing some of their retirement benefits. And it's also requiring districts to create a short-term program to educate their substitute teachers about curriculum, et cetera. I think the measure that's gotten the most media attention is the minimum wage teacher salary bill. And that bill would increase teachers' minimum wage, or the entry-level minimum wage, to $40,000 by 2022. It would be a phase-in. It's passed both houses in Springfield, and it is awaiting the governor's signature. I actually had the opportunity to ask the governor when he was visiting the Urbana area a couple weeks ago what he thought should be done about the teacher shortage. And he did say that he believes teachers should be paid more. But he seems to think that that is also up to the local school districts to decide. So he's kind of said a lot of things about this bill that have people concerned that he's not actually going to sign it, that he might actually veto it. But we don't know yet. The deadline for him to do that is next month. That's a big one that's gotten a lot of attention. I do want to point out, though, that even if the governor signed that bill into law, it wouldn't actually affect many teachers right now. There are about 7,700 educators who make less than $40,000, according to the Illinois Education Association, in the state right now. And that's a small percentage of the teachers that work in Illinois today.
Well, and it's my understanding that you also talked, and definitely for your story, Representative Tom Bennett, a lot about this. And what was his response when you were talking to him, not only about this particular bill, but what he believed we could do for teacher shortages?
So he was very proud of the teacher shortage legislation that he helped pass with Senator Menard. But he did acknowledge that that was not enough, that more needed to be done. And compensation is a big part of that issue. I think Chuck kind of got to that when he talked about balancing low pay with high debt is an issue. He also is concerned about unfunded state mandates. So I want to point out that the teacher minimum wage bill is unfunded. That means that the state of Illinois isn't giving extra money to local districts to pay to increase their salaries. So he's worried that that will negatively impact districts. But he, like Rahner, also believes that teachers should be compensated more. And he is hopeful that the new school funding formula bill will help get more resources to the neediest districts, and that that will somehow translate into higher pay for teachers. I'm somewhat skeptical of that because I think some of those needy districts have so many other things that they need to pay for with that money. I'm not sure that all of them are going to get around to or even be able to talk about increasing salaries for teachers. And it's not just salaries that are the problem here. There's also working conditions to contend with. A lot of these teachers are working in classrooms with few resources that can wear on their on the sense of respect that they feel. Right. I will say that Stacy, who we heard from, the teacher at Murfreesboro, told me that every year she writes her own curriculum because they haven't had a budget for curriculum in so long.
And Lee, we only have just a couple minutes here, but I really quickly wanted to get this in. You spoke with Chris Rogge, who's the director of the University of Illinois Council on Teacher Education. Let's take a listen to his response. What would make teaching more enticing?
Compensation, preparation, induction and mentoring, and teaching conditions. All of these things help attract people in to teaching, and they help retain people once they're there.
And Superintendent Blyer, real quick, I'm going to go to you first and then Lee. Just very quickly, what in your eyes can be done based on what he was saying there to entice, make our situation better in general?
My opinion is that the colleges and universities have to come down on their tuition and respect that the profession just in pain at the level that they're having expectations of tuition to pull from these students.
And Lee?
Yeah, I would say that a lot of this comes down to resources. So not just resources for compensation, but resources for curriculum, for facilities, for improving the environments in which teachers work in, resources for social workers to help teachers deal with an influx of kids that are coming to school with more intense behavioral health needs than they've ever seen before. I think another important thing that's happening is you know, grow your own teacher programs across the state where teachers are identifying children in their classroom who are interested in the profession and who they can, I think Chuck was sort of alluding to this, give some kind of financial benefit to, some kind of mentorship benefit to, so that they can go and get their teaching degree and then come back to that school and fill a need in that classroom. All of these things are possible, but a lot of it comes down to more resources. And I think that that's really where the central problem lies, is the state of Illinois willing to help contribute to that? And are universities willing to help contribute to that?
We've been talking about Illinois' teacher shortage with Lee Gaines, education reporter for Illinois Newsroom, and Chuck Blyer, superintendent for Wabash Community Unit School District 348 in Mount Carmel, Illinois. Thanks to both of you for joining us today on the 21st.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. Immigration policy has been a big debate on the federal level, but what should cities and towns do when it comes to their own policies? That's been one of the biggest questions in local communities across Illinois and the rest of the country. Some believe that local police should help Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, detain undocumented immigrants. Others believe that they shouldn't and that their cities and towns need to create policies that reflect their communities. In other words, take a public stand against the federal government's approach to detention and deportation. In Bloomington Normal, the debate over welcoming city ordinance has been a contentious one. Normal passed one in May, but Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner canceled a vote on a proposed ordinance for the second time this year. And this issue is anything but resolved. For more on this, I'm joined by Ryan Denham, who is reporting on this with his colleagues at WGLT in Normal. Ryan, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So, Ryan, I'd like to start by recapping the backstory of this issue for those of us who haven't been following it closely. So, what is a welcome city ordinance, and how did it first become such a contentious issue or local debate there in Bloomington Normal?
Well, it's been going on here for more than a year and a half, actually. And a welcoming city ordinance is you know, half symbolic and half actually practical. So, and both sort of relate to what's been going on with the Trump administration. I think we have a pretty active kind of progressive activist base here in McLean County. And in response to what they've been seeing out of the Trump administration, they've become really motivated and activated on the immigration issue. So the ordinance itself does a couple of things. At its core, it restricts the types of communications and cooperation between local police and federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Basically restricts the types of relationships that can occur between police and ICE. And on the symbolic side, it's just a matter of you know, saying publicly to the immigrant community here that, you know, these communities are literally welcoming to you.
And can you give us a sense of the immigrant communities that are living in Bloomington Normal today?
Sure, it's, you know, always hard to put a precise number on it, but you know, the census shows that we've got, you know, we've got 172,000 people here. So about 7% of those are foreign born. It's, you know, about 11,000 people. Most of those are not citizens. I think uniquely here we've got, you know, a couple of college campuses, including Illinois State University, which, you know, is a pretty interesting part of our immigrant community. We've done some reporting about undocumented students at ISU and some of the anxiety they feel about just, like, day-to-day life, going out and about in the community and what that feels like. And it's, you know, it's really put a face on the issue for us.
Absolutely. And Ryan, we first talked about this issue back in April when the 21st did a series of shows from Bloomington Normal, in fact, recorded at your station, WGLT. And we'll tweet that first conversation out if you'd like to hear it. And we'll also have it up on our website for people to go see. But now, months later, as I mentioned in the introduction, Normal has passed its welcoming city ordinance. Bloomington has not. So in real day-to-day practice, have you seen what Normal's ordinance does?
It's still pretty young, but I can go over a couple of things that the ordinance spells out. So it says that the town of Normal's employees, you know, primarily police officers, cannot ask someone's citizenship or immigration status mm-hmm. unless it's required by law or court order. And if they do ask, they have to explain why they're asking. It says police can't investigate someone solely for an immigration violation. And notably, it says that Normal police officers must get approval from their police chief prior to collaborating or communicating with ICE, the Federal Immigration Authority. So that last one is probably the most important one for the activists who are pushing for it.
And so kind of to get to the activists here. So this week we mentioned Bloomington's Mayor Terry Renner canceled a vote on the Bloomington side of the city welcoming city ordinance for the second time, I might add, this year. So what happened this time? Why was it canceled?
Yeah, I mean, the first time around, it was canceled because a majority of aldermen were expressing concerns about the ordinance. They didn't like what they were seeing. They didn't want to vote for it. And so they kind of banded together and made sure that didn't happen. This time, you know, the mayor was sensing a similar opposition from the council. But then at the same time, the activists themselves, it's this coalition called the Keep Families Together Coalition, they came out against the latest version of the ordinance too. So with nobody but the mayor seemingly in favor of it, I think he felt he maybe didn't have any other choice but to call it off.
So, Ryan, I have to ask for some clarification here, because if I'm to understand correctly, the immigrant rights activists that you're mentioning were the ones to actually bring this idea of a welcoming city ordinance forward in the first place, but now they're opposing it. So could you explain what's happened in between those two events?
Sure. It's all about threading the needle on a really difficult public policy issue. So I think what the mayor was trying to come up with was a version of this ordinance that would, one, pass through the city council on a divided vote, probably going to be a 5-4 vote, and then changing the ordinance to try to get to that point, something that everybody could be happy with. But in doing so, the activists felt that it was being watered down too much. So, for example, they thought that this latest version of Bloomington's ordinance was just too permissive and did not do enough to control those relationships and communications between police and ICE. And once they saw it being watered down that much, they came out vocally against it.
So normally when we do talk about this issue, we frame it as a question, right? So do you think local law enforcement should help federal immigration officials or not? Clearly, for many activists, their answer to this question has been no for quite some time. But Ryan, in Bloomington Normal, are you getting a sense that there are many vocal supporters who think that, yes, in fact, local police should step in, they should help ICE detain undocumented immigrants, like from a community standpoint?
Well, it's hard to say. Certainly, if you have 100 activists coming out to push the ordinance and the idea of passing one, you know, there's not 100 folks on the other side, you know, shouting the exact opposite. However, there is a pretty vocal group that has defended police. And I think police have made that argument that, hey, we are not routinely working with federal immigration authorities anyway. It's not like we're going out on roundups and picking up immigrants on a daily basis and bringing them to the jail and shipping them home. So that I think that contingent of the community, you know, has tried to make that point and defended police, and mm-hmm. the police chiefs themselves have done the same.
And as we have talked about here in this conversation, Normal has a welcoming city ordinance. Bloomington does not. There could be one in the future. They just keep canceling the vote, right? But people live and work, much like in Champaign-Urbana, where we are right now today. They work and live in between the two, between Bloomington and Normal. They kind of flow into each other. So what does Normal's ordinance mean if Bloomington doesn't have a similar one when you can cross a street and be in either town?
Yeah, and that flow is really important. I mean, Bloomington and Normal do a lot of the same things on purpose. I mean, even small stuff like how Uber and Lyft cars are regulated and sales tax levels and all that. I mean, it's all very much done the same intentionally.
Right.
So this is an interesting case of them having different approaches, at least temporarily here. So on the surface, you know, we're going to have to let it play out, obviously. But on the surface, it appear that, you know, if you're an immigrant, an undocumented immigrant especially, living in Normal, and say you have a break-in at your house or your apartments, you may feel more comfortable calling the police to report that than you would if you were living in Bloomington and they did not have this ordinance approach to governing police interactions with ICE. That would be my guess as at least for the time being, what that will feel like and how different that will be.
Well, and Ryan, looking towards the future, what's next here? What are some of the biggest questions you have about this issue in the next coming week, maybe months?
Well, from a practical standpoint, the mayor of Bloomington has recommended to the police chief to come up with some policies and procedures and for how his department will interact with ICE and to disseminate them widely. The police chief says he's going to be talking with the immigration community here in town, the activists who've been pushing for this. So it's sort of been put into his court to kind of take the next step. You know, as a journalist, I'm certainly interested in seeing if there's any glaring examples of police having an inappropriate relationship or communication with ICE in the coming months. Like if there is some glaring case that pops up that activists point to that's saying, hey, this seriously was why we needed it. If something like that comes up and kind of puts the focus back on the issue, we could see the council come back to it, but barring that, I don't know that it will.
That's WGLT's Ryan Denham. We'll tweet out some of his reporting that he's been doing to help us learn more about this issue. Ryan, thanks so much for making time for us here at the 21st.
Thanks, Liz.
This is the 21st. Summer is finally in full swing, so hopefully wherever you are in Illinois, you're making the most out of it. For cyclists and for folks who are just hoping to get on their bikes a little bit more, it's a chance to explore some of Illinois' bike trails. To help with some suggestions as well as tips for biking during the summer, I'm joined by James Radall, service manager with Neutral Cycle in Champaign. Hi, James. Thanks so much for being here.
Hello. Good to be here.
So, James, before we get to some suggestions, it's about the middle of summer right now. And I know that we had a long, cold start to the year, but now that it's warming up, I'm sure everybody likes to get out there. So what are summers like for you as far as cycling goes? So where do you find yourself gravitating towards in the state?
Well, I like to do a lot of bike touring, and we've got a lot of good country roads here. It's really fun. We've got a lot of great parks, and there's a lot of really good trails. We've got trails like Tunnel Hill down in southern Illinois, which are wonderful, and you can make a heck of a weekend trip out of that.
Okay.
And then early morning mountain biking when it's nice and cool.
Okay. I don't think that most people think of mountain biking in Illinois, so can you go a little bit into what you mean by that?
Well, we actually have some pretty okay mountain bike trails.
Okay.
The people in central Illinois really enjoy them. They're very good. They're definitely not the Rocky Mountains. But throughout Illinois, there are mountain bike trails located primarily in ravine sections around lakes. And so we have Kickapoo State Park, which has the coal mine pond sort of ravines.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got some really good mountain biking trail, the Kickapoo Mountain Bike Club. They have done a lot of work and built a great trail system. Peoria has good trails. And up in Chicago, Palos Park has really good miles and miles of trails.
So you mentioned Kickapoo, and one of your suggestions that you brought with us or brought with you today for us is the Kickapoo Rail Trail. So I know that's been in construction for a couple of years, but is that available to the public now?
That is.
And could you give us a sense of what that trail is like?
Sure. The Kickapoo Rail Trail is a 25-mile trail. It is being completed in four sections. Section one is done, so we can ride from Urbana, Illinois, to St. Joe, Illinois. It's a beautiful trail. It starts at Weaver Park and goes to essentially the center of downtown St. Joe. It goes through the prairie. There are lots of nice sort of hedgerow sections where it's wooded and shaded, good scenery. It's a rock and chip trail, and a lot of people will read that a path is rock, and they think they need, you know, like a mountain bike or big tires. And you can ride this with any road bike, really any bike you would like, because it is a hardened dirt surface underneath with a sprinkling of rock just to help with traction.
Okay. And you also mentioned earlier Southern Illinois and having some really great trails down there. So you had suggested one before, but I've also heard of Trek Trail in Effingham. So do you like that one? What do you suggest with that one?
That one's near and dear to my heart. It's in Effingham, Illinois, and I'm from Totopolis, which is a stone's throw away. And they've done a really great job. The Trek Trail goes from Effingham to Lake Sarah. And it's been a little bit of a struggle because of funding and getting the state to work with them. But they've really outdone themselves. They've got a bicycle and pedestrian-only bridge over the overpass, over the interstate.
Oh, okay.
So you can start in Effingham, and you can actually start at the Effingham Junior High School complex, cross the street, get onto the overpass for the interstate, and then ride through a beautiful wooded section. They've got hills, which are a little hard to find, and go all the way to Lake Sarah.
So another one on your list I've heard is the Lake Shelbyville Trail. So could you tell us about that one? What can one could expect going there?
Sure. So Shelbyville is really got a lot of things going for bike trails. The lake itself has a pretty extensive trail network that is a nice paved path. Mm-hmm. And throughout the summers, the Army Corps of Engineers, they actually provide sort of trail rangers who will ride through the trail and make sure you're okay, you know, if you need water, if somebody falls over and gets hurt. Level paths, lots of restrooms and water fountains, lots of parking. In Forest Park, which is a park in Shelbyville, is the trailhead for the General Dacey Trail, which is a 6-mile trail, a little bit more elevation, but not, you know, no real hills. And that one's really nice as well. And they actually do a lot of events there.
Okay. And James, what I'd really like to get a sense of from you, because I myself, I know how to bike, right? Like, I know how to ride a bike. I enjoy it. But I'm not an avid cyclist. But if I were to, say, want to start commuting to work or doing it as a form of exercise, and I'm not ready for trail yet, so to speak, what is your advice for those just kind of getting started?
Sure. I would say set yourself up for success.
I like that plan.
Sure. If you want to do this, make sure you've got the necessary gear. And you don't need a lot of gear. You know, you want to make sure your bike's in good shape, tires are aired up.
Okay.
Definitely want to pick up a helmet.
Mm-hmm.
Helmets are not required by law, but it's one of those things you want it the one time you need it.
Right.
You want to leave early, bring water, prepare, and don't be intimidated by the trails. The trails in the pass are actually some of the best places to ride. The Kickapoo Rail, the trail, only has, I think, 5 road crossings. And so perfectly flat. You never get more than a 1% grade on that trail. No cars to speak of. Really easy. You know, riding to work is really nice. What you can do is leave on a Saturday. Time yourself, and then you can find out how long it really takes.
Well, I want to thank James Radel from Neutral Cycle in Champaign-Urbana. James, thanks so much for your time and your expertise.
Thank you for letting me come.
And we'll have James' bike route suggestions up on our website, 21stshow.org. Thanks so much for listening. This is The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. There are a lot of great bike trails in Illinois, but imagine biking across the U.S. If you're Daniel DeVise, that's not so far-fetched. He comes from a long line of cyclists, including his father, Chicagoan Pierre DeVise, and his uncle, Jacques, who are the youngest people in history to ever cross the United States by bicycle. Daniel is an author and a journalist, and he's recently written a book about cycling called The Comeback. He joins us now on the line from Reno, where he's visiting as a part of his book tour. Daniel, welcome to The 21st.
Hey, great to be here.
So, Daniel, you described this epic bike trip in the Chicago Reader recently, and for our listeners, we will be tweeting that story out for anyone who hasn't seen it at 21ST Show. But first, I want to learn a little bit more about your family. In particular, your father's family came to America from Belgium in 1934. So what brought them here?
Well, they were escaping the, you know, the menace of looming war. They'd actually been in Germany on their bicycles, I think, the previous year, and gotten a feel for what was going on in Hitler's Germany, and they wanted to be away from it. So Victor, my grandfather, packed up his two boys. The mother had died previously. And they shipped over to New York Harbor in, I think it was spring of 1935 that they arrived.
Okay.
And they were just coming to America for the same reasons a lot of people were in the 1930s. It was so unstable in Europe.
And you kind of referenced this, but I believe your grandfather, Victor, not only was he a writer like you, he was also an avid cyclist. And I believe you describe him cycling from Belgium to Berlin to see Hitler during those times. As you were talking about, they were taking trips, but I think they were on bicycle, correct?
Yes, they rode their bicycles everywhere. And if anyone in the listening audience has Belgian heritage, it's not so weird, for Belgians are crazy about cycling. They bicycle everywhere. They had bicycled around Belgium, probably across Belgium, into Germany. And all this by the time my father was 9 or 10 years old. It's just a huge passion in Belgium.
So your family comes over to America. You said they landed in New York. So how did your grandfather, Victor, come to choose to live in Illinois?
Gosh, I don't know that they initially were planning to live in Illinois. I think their initial plan was Victor, the grandfather, wanted to make his way to Hollywood. And I think he was planning to cover, you know, the stars for the Belgian Star, which was a publication. They did eventually wind up in Chicago, but I'm getting ahead of myself. The first thing was that they set a goal of making their way to Hollywood. After they'd been in Hollywood for a while, they returned to Chicago. They passed through there on this epic bicycle ride, and I guess they'd fallen in love with it, and they wound up staying there. My father spent his entire adult life in Chicago, and that's where I was born. Now, the rest of the family scattered. Jacques, my uncle, wound up in Cincinnati, and Victor made his way back to Hollywood, and I think he died there, and that was when I was a couple years old, probably around 1970. But my father was the one who really made his life in Chicago.
So you talked about this love of cycling starting with your family back in Europe, and certainly biking and cycling is one thing. But when your family arrives in America, just exactly how soon after did they decide that they were going to be bicycling across the country?
Well, I heard this story many times over the course of my life from my father, and my less often from my uncle, and they were little. They were 9 and 10, so their recollections weren't perfectly sort of logical and comprehensive, but their understanding of what happened was that Victor, the father, just had this kind of crazy plan that he wanted to do this. Now, I suspect that he was partly looking to, you know, maybe drum up some news, maybe make a little bit of a spectacle of the family, get some press, hold some news conferences, maybe by way of furthering his own writing or journalism career. That's what they did. They stopped in Pittsburgh, they stopped in Chicago and in some other cities, and in these places they would summon the press, and Victor, the father, would regale them with stories of their cross-country journey. But as far as I can tell from interviewing my now deceased father and uncle, they set out very quickly after arriving in New York as if it was their plan all along.
Oh, okay. And you kind of started to describe their route, talking about Pittsburgh and so on, but can you really paint a picture for us? So it's your grandfather, your father, and your uncle, so just the three of them, your father and your uncle are very young, as you mentioned, around 10 at the time. So can you describe what the day-to-day of this route was for them, some of the major cities they stopped in, how many miles they were taking on per day, what kind of activities outside of cycling they might do on their cross-country trek?
Well, my recollection is that they did about 70 miles a day, 70 or 80 miles, which means that the entire voyage, and I'm going to forget, it was around 3,000 miles, took around 45 days. And they took the old Lincoln Highway, which passes through those cities you named, Des Moines, and through Reno, where I am now, and it winds up in the northern half of California. My guess would be that Victor, the grandfather, chose the Lincoln Highway because it's farther north.
Right.
So it would be cooler. They wouldn't be going through the worst of the desert country. But according to my father and uncle, there were parts of the route that were absolutely just barren, arid wasteland. And where they stayed, there were these sort of lean-tos along the route. In some cases, they slept on Indian reservations. In other cases, it was these sort of dirt-floored shacks. It was sort of like this was before the era that there were Motel 6s everywhere, so you
right.
just stayed where you could.
Right. And you had mentioned that your grandfather in particular, would contact the press in larger cities and try to drum up some exposure for them, or at least for him in his journalism career. And it was historic at the end of the day, especially for your father and your uncle. So do you have any sense, or have you read any of those articles of that press coverage and what they were saying about your family in this trek at the time that it was happening?
Yeah, I found probably 8 or 10 different clippings. There was the most extensive coverage was in those two cities, Pittsburgh and Chicago. The Tribune wrote a significant article about them. The Pittsburgh Press, I think, wrote a lengthy article. Anybody in the listening audience who has access to newspapers.com can type in the names of my kin and find those accounts. And you know, the tone of the articles was one of wonderment, I think, that these 9 and 10 year old kids in Argyle sweaters were riding their bicycles across the country. As I said at the outset, I am asserting in this article that published in the Reader that they were at the time the youngest to mm-hmm. have made this journey. That was always what they told me. And I did some research and I contacted the Cycling Hall of Fame and the USA Cycling Organization, and nobody I contacted had any information to the contrary. In other words, there's no evidence that I ever came across of anybody earlier at a younger age to have done this, you know, crazy journey.
I mean, it is quite a trek. Thinking of myself at 10 years old, I certainly would not have the patience or focus to travel a couple miles, let alone over 3,000. But I assume that the love for cycling, the hobby of it, was passed on through the generations. So what was the best place that your father ever took you biking? And would you have any tips for any listeners out there who are like, oh, I'd really like to do some sort of long-form cycling, maybe perhaps not coast-to-coast, but, you know, something that's a little bit longer than your afternoon jaunt?
Well, the scene for cycling is so different now than it was. When I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, my father and I would be nearly the only cyclists out on the road in a lot of cases. We would ride up along Sheridan Road toward the Glenview Naval Air Station, I think it's called. We wouldn't necessarily make it all the way, but we'd aim for that target. We'd also take the Caldwell Woods Path, which goes through along a branch of the Chicago River.
Mm-hmm.
And again, if you can picture this, there would be almost no other cyclists on these routes, even though those were the best routes. Nowadays, in Chicago, there are cyclists everywhere. They're very, shall we say, assertive, and there's no longer this sort of pall of fear that hangs over a cyclist riding through the city. Now, as to the rest of the region around Chicago, all I can say is I can promise you it's much, much, much better for the cyclist than it ever was. If you know the name Lon Haldeman, he won the Race Across America, which was an official sort of sanctioned event in the 80s and forward from then that had people race across the country, adults, you know, trained adults. Lon came from northern Illinois, and he used to ride, I think, 50 miles back and forth across the northern part of the state to his job every day. And I'm sure that Lon was also kind of alone out on the roads. There just weren't a lot of cyclists out there.
And cycling has been more than just a hobby for you, right? Your new book, The Comeback, takes a look at this world. And we have just a minute left, but if you could tell us a little bit about that.
You know, because I grew up as a huge cycling buff, I'd always loved my memories of watching the great Greg LeMond, who was the first American to conquer professional cycling in the modern era. Greg LeMond won the Tour in 1986, and then he won the Tour de France again in 89 in the most spectacular fashion imaginable. It was the closest finish in the history of the race. So the book, The Comeback, is not about my father, who was a great bicycle racer, but it's about LeMond, the greatest modern American bicycle racer, and about his just astonishing career and the amazing ups and downs that he went through over the course of his sort of life journey.
That's Daniel DeVise. His father, Pierre, was one of two brothers to become the youngest in history to bike across the U.S. His new book on cycling is called The Comeback. Daniel, thanks so much for joining us here on the 21st and sharing your story.
Oh, thank you.
You are listening to The 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. Summer can bring fun outside, maybe to enjoy a drink. Perhaps you're having that drink in a red plastic cup. At least the makers of Solo Cups certainly hope so. But did you know that these party cups, immediately recognizable from across a crowded lawn, actually have roots here in Illinois? Urbana, to be exact. And the roots go even deeper, back almost 90 years. Chris Borelli recently dug into the 16-ounce history and design of our favorite cup. He's on the line with me from Chicago Tribune, where he is a features writer. Chris, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Chris, as you point out, there are few modern party utensils more prevalent than the red Solo cup. They're utilitarian. Yeah. They also have, as you describe, and I quote, a cultural signifier of communal togetherness and a darker cultural reminder of excess. Love that quote. Pretty heavy description for a plastic cup, but pretty accurate. So could you give us a sense of where this tradition originated?
The tradition of the cup or the tradition of the... of the dark side of the cup.
Let's just go with the history of the cup itself.
The history of the cup started, it came out of, there's a lot here to cram in. So it came out of basically there was a need for disposable cups everywhere, the entire country. But in Chicago in particular, there was a need for disposable cups because for a long time, the cup was kind of, what you did was you sort of pulled out of a giant bucket of water, essentially. Mm. It was like a trough, you know, it was like communal troughs and communal cups, and that's a great way of spreading disease. So a company on the south side started marketing cone cups, you know, the sort of cone cups that you
right.
pull out. And partly, by the way, one of the reasons they're a cone is that because you can't set them down.
Oh, okay.
So they don't, you know, and therefore you can't pass them on and pass on disease. So flash forward, about 40 years roughly from there, the Hustlemans, which is a family out of Winnetka that owned Solo, they were looking at just kind of a sturdier cup, you know, a cup that was made with basically layers of plastic. I don't want to get too wonky here, but basically they were just, you know, the actual inspiration for the cup and for the innovation of the cup itself is a little bit unclear. Even the company itself, Dart Container, which out of Michigan, which now owns Solo, they're not even completely clear on why the Hustleman family designed the cup in the first place. They're completely not sure. They're not even sure what day it happened or when it was invented or that kind of thing. It's just, it's a little bit lost to history. Nobody in the family can kind of agree on a date or anything, but essentially it's a really sturdy cup. So, you know, as time kind of goes on, they introduced the cup in the early 70s, starts to catch on in frat houses and college campuses, and it's very sturdy. It works great with beer games, you know, like beer pong and stuff.
Right.
Like that.
And before we get to that part of that, I just want to let our listeners know we're going to be tweeting out your story and linking to it from our website, 21stshow.org, because you did actually visit the plant here in Urbana, which is now owned by Dart, and you get into the makings of the cup itself. But if we could talk a little bit about the cultural significance, this idea that it is associated with frat parties. Does Solo Cup like this? Just really quickly, yes or no?
Does Solo Cups like this? that is a hard question to answer. I would say officially no.
Okay.
They don't like it. But I would say, you know, you know, it does has not hurt the brand, obviously. It's like, you know, it's immediately recognizable and, you know, generations know what it means for good and bad.
So, well, Chris, hate to cut you off. We're just going to have to go with It's Complicated. That's Chicago Tribune feature writer Chris Borelli. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I want to thank you so much for listening.